I ran across an article by Kat Brooks in the San Francisco Chronicle entitled "Movement Stalls in Progressive Santa Cruz on Police Reform" in the Open Forum column. It's on the 28th that this article got published. Kat Brooks is described as an award-winning actress, playwright, the executive director of the Justice Teams Network, which I haven't heard of before, and the co-founder of the Anti-Police Terror Project, and the co-host of Up Front on KPFA. I don't know about that last. I'm not a big KPFA fan these days, but I liked a lot of the article, and I'm going to read it, or at least some of it for you. After a year that had already seen a spate of officer-involved killings, 2015 ended with San Francisco police officers shooting Mario Woods to death over a kitchen knife. As tragic as that moment was, however, it was also the beginning of an avalanche of movement building. Pressure in the aftermath of the Woods shooting helped turn the San Francisco Police Commission into the strongest civil oversight board in the country, at least in theory. It also led to the hiring of Bill Scott, a San Francisco Police Department chief, under the promise of reform. That same avalanche eventually led to the election of progressive district attorney Chesa Boudin, despite the San Francisco Police Officers Association dumping $400,000 into television ads to defeat him. And this year, for the first time, Boudin put a police officer in San Francisco, Terrence Stengel, on trial for the 2019 beating that left Discari Spears with broken bones and permanent disabilities. Now all that progress is exploding. On the eve of Stengel's trial, Chief Scott, days before he was to face a vote of no confidence from the San Francisco Police Officers Association, very publicly pulled out of a memorandum of understanding with the district attorney's office to allow independent investigations of excessive uses of force. Scott justified his action in part by suggesting that Boudin's office probably withheld evidence from Stengel's defense team, a claim the judge presiding over the trial denied. The dominoes kept tumbling. The police commission, whose job it was to direct Scott, failed to direct the chief to maintain the memorandum of understanding. Then Stengel was found not guilty by a jury that no doubt saw the scandalous headlines. The police commission subsequently lost its most strident critic when John Hamasak announced his resignation. And a recent poll revealed Boudin is likely to fall victim to a recall effort driven by a Republican and police union smear campaign. What the hell is happening in San Francisco? Hamasaki joined the San Francisco Police Commission in 2018 with hopes of riding a national wave of demands for police reform and accountability. And for a minute, he believed a teensy bit of progress was on the horizon. After the memorandum went into effect, there were zero deadly officer-involved shootings in 2019. In 2020 and 2021, there were just one per year. Meanwhile, three officers, in addition to Stengel, were charged for violent behavior, and the city began civilian response programs to combat the community safety crises that can't be solved with badges and guns. Things weren't perfect. A report by the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice showed the department continued to arrest the city's diminishing black population at disparate rates. And recently released data showed black people were 12 times more likely than white people to be subjected to police force. Latinos were 5 times more likely. That's horrific. Some progress is better than none, I guess. Better than the backsliding we're looking at now. Hamasaki said Scott's pulling out of the memorandum, that's the memorandum that said there should be independent investigations of excessive uses of force by the police department and not simply an in-house police department sponsored look at the claims of excessive force. Hamasaki said Scott's pulling out of the memorandum should have been met with headlines that read, "San Francisco Police Commission orders Chief Scott to remain in the MOU, Memorandum of Understanding." No such luck. What does our authority matter if we don't use it when our backs are against the wall? He said in an interview. Like so many of us, Hamasaki is tired. Tired and unsure of how to be impactful or effective in a national climate where the elected officials are backing away from demands for police accountability in the face of billionaires funding recall efforts for politicians they could not defeat in democratically run elections. While I believe that we have done some good work, Hamasaki said, we have failed at changing the culture. A culture that balks at accountability. Boudin campaigned on police accountability, and true to his word, he has charged four police officers with abusing their power. And yet these efforts have been a lightning rod. I never suggested that people watch the violent videos that dominate social media, but if you do, you will clearly see Officer Stangel violating any sane interpretation of the San Francisco Police Department's use of force policy in beating Spears. Stangel's trial proceedings reminded us that Spears' girlfriend denied an assault occurred, that Spears was never charged with any crime, and that the Sacramento tourist who called 911 told the district attorney's office investigators she never actually saw Spears hitting his girlfriend. And it turned out that the ones playing dirty ball in this case were police. The department determined to protect its own withheld evidence from the prosecution. Stangel walked, nevertheless. And we who live in the supposedly liberal bastion in the Bay Area are left scratching our heads, wondering why, with so much overwhelming evidence, an approved city abuse settlement, and a district attorney willing to hold bad actors to account, was justice not served? Was the jury tainted by media coverage of Scott's move? That's certainly one question. But perhaps the more important ones are this. Where does the department go now? What will happen to Chief Scott's promises of reform and accountability, or to his efforts to change the decades-long violent culture of the department? What message does this send to police about what they can get away with? San Francisco is in danger of regressing to a time when police violence goes unchecked and unfettered. If so, it will undoubtedly make things even more difficult than they already are to push for real change inside the department. If progressive San Francisco can't get it right, the forecast for the nation is grim. That's Cat Brooks, Movement Stalls in Progressive San Francisco, his open forum column in the 28th of March San Francisco Chronicle. And here's another story, also in the Chronicle from the 28th, same paper, same day, by Bob Gelko. Man, no threat to officer before slaying, court rules. A Riverside County Sheriff's Office said Clemente Najera Aguirre was headed towards him with a baseball bat when the officer fired six shots at Najera and killed him. But a coroner's report found that Najera was killed by two shots to his back, and his children can proceed with a suit against the officer, a federal appeals court said Thursday. While Sergeant Dan Ponder still contends Najera posed a threat to him and to bystanders at the time of the shooting in April 2016, the coroner's findings create a factional dispute for a jury to resolve, said the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. Based on the facts alleged in the lawsuit, Najera, quote, presented no threat at all to the officer or anyone else in that moment, Judge M. Margaret McKeon wrote in the 3-0 ruling. It upheld a federal judge's refusal to dismiss the suit by Najera's three children accusing Ponder of using excessive force. Ponder, a law enforcement officer for 30 years, went to the home in Lake Elsinore after a radio call saying a man was destroying property with a baseball bat and had threatened a woman. The officer got out of his car with his gun drawn and said he saw Najera holding a stick, which he refused to drop. He tried to pepper spray Najera, but the spray mostly blew back in the officer's face and had no apparent effect on Najera, the court said. At that point, witnesses gave different accounts. Some said Najera picked up a baseball bat from a nearby bushes and walked toward Ponder with his one stick raised. Others said he stood still with his stick pointed downward. Ponder fired the fatal shots from 15 feet away, the court said. Citing the coroner's report, McCowan said, that's the judge, the bullet paths suggested that Najera had turned away from the officer and was falling to the ground when the bullet struck. She said there was no evidence that Najera was approaching or threatening bystanders. Ponder's lawyers also argued that even if he had used excessive force, he was legally immune because court cases at the time had not yet established that an officer was barred from shooting a suspect who was carrying a stick or any other weapon, a doctrine known as qualified immunity. But the court said the law was clear-cut. For example, McCowan said a Ninth Circuit ruling in 2013 allowed a suit against a San Diego County officer for fatally shooting a man who was standing 6 to 8 feet away and holding a knife with the blade pointing downward. Another 2013 ruling by the court allowed a suit against three sheriff's deputies in Santa Barbara County for shooting and killing a man who was holding a gun pointed downward while standing on his porch. Those rulings showed that officers, quote, must not use deadly force against non-threatening suspects, even if those suspects are armed, McCowan said, or wrote. Gail Galipo, a lawyer for the children, said Najera, 36, had been in a mental health crisis and was acting out, but was not threatening Ponder or anyone else. He said he was pleased the court had set some limitations on qualified immunity, a common ground for dismissing lawsuits against police. And remember, you who are listening to this reading, we're not talking about even firing the police officer or holding him accountable that way. We're just talking about making the city cough up some money so he can continue to do what he always does, if the police chief wants him on. This is just sort of the cost of doing business. Most people are looking for more accountability for excessive use of force, Galipo said. Instead of an officer saying, we're here to help you, they start pointing weapons, shouting commands, and the next thing you know, they're shooting. The Riverside County Sheriff's Office said it respectfully disagrees with the ruling and will examine its options. The county could ask for a full appeals court for a new hearing before a larger panel, appeal to the Supreme Court, or let the case go to trial. And then my comment is, this is by Bob Agelko, this story, man no threat to officer before slaying, court rules. But my comment is that there's no district attorney there like Boudin in San Francisco, who's now threatened with recall, who wants to try the officer for murder or manslaughter or in some way hold him responsible for what goes on. We have the same problem here in Santa Cruz. And here's a subject I haven't covered much in recent netcasts, but this article caught my interest. It's in the March 27th Chronicle. Cannabis bill could backfire, critics fear. Loophole in measure may cut patient access, they say. Shelby should say cut patient access even further. It's by Jackie Bryant. Californians voted in favor of Proposition 64 in 2016 and legalized the adult use cannabis industry. They gave municipalities the ability to opt out of cultivation, manufacturing, and retail sales. A new bill appeared to challenge that key provision of local control. It appears to challenge it, but there's an ongoing debate over its intentions and what it would mean in practice. SB 1186 by Senator Scott Wiener would enact the Medicinal Cannabis Patients' Right of Access Act. Good sounding name. It is intended to prevent local governments from enacting bans or unreasonable restrictions around medical cannabis sales. The measure is seeking to ensure that the voter initiative legalizing medical cannabis in California, that's Proposition 215, passed back in 1996, isn't undermined by the more recent Proposition 64, which many of us thought it would be, which legalized recreational adult cannabis use but allowed for local bans on dispensaries. Proposition 64 explicitly did not give cities and counties local control over medical cannabis businesses. The later passage of SB 94 in 2017, the Medicinal Adult Use Cannabis Legislation and Safety Act, was intended to bridge together the medical and adult use propositions and ended up allowing localities to prohibit medical cannabis. If passed, California's local governments would be forced to legalize medical cannabis sales with only a couple of exceptions. Supporters of the bill include Hirsch Jain of the cannabis consultancy Ananda Strategy, are calling it a major milestone in the maturation of the California cannabis industry. Jain, who is also the vice chair of the California Chamber of Commerce and sits on the board of directors for the Los Angeles chapter of NORML, a pro-cannabis advocacy organization, said SB 1186 has the potential to significantly expand retail cannabis access in California by creating markets where they previously didn't exist. He's a market man. Jain said that more than 200 of California's 482 cities ban any form of retail cannabis sales, whether through storefront or delivery, adult use, or medical. This bill would force those 300-plus municipalities to either allow at least one medical cannabis storefront, delivery service, or both. Opponents of local control provisions say the lack of cannabis access statewide is not only a medical issue for patients, it also provides the illegal market with a way to thrive, since customers can't easily access legal cannabis. But there is one line in the bill's current language that has caused pro-cannabis advocates to balk. One section appears to allow local governments to ban delivery while also giving the state the ability to enforce local bans. Lobbyists and lawyers and other advocates said the language is unclear. It gives the local jurisdiction the power to limit medical cannabis sales only to medical delivery or one or more brick-and-mortar storefront or both, whichever it chooses. The key to the debate, advocates say, is that it provides the option to choose just a storefront and disallow delivery. That could allow a jurisdiction to prohibit new medical cannabis deliveries and to uphold any existing local cannabis sales bans, which state law currently supersedes. Currently, residents in areas with bans can still legally access cannabis through deliveries. For cannabis access, say the bill could therefore limit, rather than expand, access by creating a loophole. While I fully support the intent of this legislation, the practical application of it is not as simple as most people believe, said Nate Bradley, executive director of the Cannabis Consumer Policy Council. California cities have been fighting long and hard, Bradley said, for the ability to ban deliveries from outside of their jurisdictions. He points to the efforts in 2018 by the then Bureau of Cannabis Control to enact delivery statewide, over the objections of the California Police Chiefs Association, League of California Cities, and United Food and Commercial Workers Western States Council, which opposed the rule that eventually became law. He said the language in the bill might allow local governments to enforce complete bans on deliveries. 14% of the sales in California's cannabis market come from deliveries, according to cannabis data company Headset's sample of more than 250 retail connections. Bradley said that though he lives in a cannabis desert city that currently has a ban on sales, he still has access to numerous delivery services. Taking that away and forcing me to make my purchases from a single store that doesn't have to compete and can charge whatever they like does not increase patient access at all, Bradley said. He believes the confusion could be cleared up if the author's office simply amends SB 1186 to clarify that his bill in no way allows cities to ban deliveries from outside their jurisdiction. Wiener's office challenged the notion that the bill does anything to chip away at legal cannabis access. Quote, "The bill does not reduce access in any way," said Katie Stewart, Wiener's communication director. "Cities currently have the ability to ban everything, and almost two-thirds do. This legislation forces city to legalize either delivery or storefront or both. It does not in any way reduce what is currently legal," she said. Stewart said that some jurisdictions with full commercial cannabis bans also ban licensed delivery operators from delivering to addresses within their jurisdiction and enforce these bans with steep fines to licensed delivery operators who violate them. This patchwork of existing prohibitions creates uncertainty for businesses and reduces access for medicinal patients and patients, she said. SB 1186 is intended to provide medicinal access above and beyond what is currently offered, Stewart said, in part by requiring jurisdictions to provide additional access for medical patients from retailers located in their own neighborhoods. Many of SB 1186's critics agree that the bill appears to create more access, but caution that cannabis legislation has a long history of imprecise language that can create problems down the road requiring legislative cleanup. Bills like this can do a lot of good or immense harm if the language isn't fully clarified, said Hillary Bricken of Los Angeles law firm Harris Bricken. Though the bill does provide a seemingly significant challenge to local control, the kicker is that it's not guaranteed what kind of medical cannabis outfits can be chosen by cities that would be deemed either automatically reasonable or unreasonable under this law, Bricken said. Omar Figueroa, a cannabis lawyer whose firm has offices in Sevastopol and New York, said the bill, if passed, would represent a symbolic rollback of Proposition 64's local control. But he found another potential snag in the language that would have wide-ranging consequences. The bill doesn't prohibit localities from enacting new medical bans in the future. In those local jurisdictions that ban medical cannabis sales entirely, SB 1186 would be an improvement over the status quo. In those local jurisdictions which already allow for medical cannabis sales, SB 1186, if passed, would give local delivery bans the imprimatur of state law, and any new medical delivery bans would erode patient access, Figueroa said. Regarding the delivery quandary, Bricken said, the cities wouldn't be able to ban essential parts or services of a medical cannabis business that would allow it to provide access. If a business revolves around delivery and it's medical, the delivery problem couldn't be eliminated, she said. Still, the delivery probably couldn't be eliminated. Still, Bricken said, the main question is whether banning delivery would be considered unreasonable if other means of sale are available, like brick and mortar. She thinks the bill doesn't expressly address that aspect. It's a little tricky and confusing, for sure, but it does raise some issues you don't usually find in mainstream media. So while you ponder that, you can hear a little music.
A whole new meaning to the word antitrust, and you say you don't know what our demands are, and then you got the boom, and we got the bust, and you say you don't know what our demands are. You sank our economy without breaking a sweat. You rode your golden parachute into your gilded safety net, and now you're swimming in credit, and we're drowning in debt. And you say you don't know what our demands. Mic check. Tear down this wall. This is your last courtesy call. What's gone around is coming round. Tear down this wall. say you're too big to fail, although that's what you do best. And you say you don't know what our demands are, and somehow all of our pensions wind up in your treasure chest. And you say you don't know what our demands are. You emerge from your mansions dressed like third world dictators, screeching, no one can tax us because we're the job creators. So we ask where the jobs are, and you're like, maybe later. And you say you don't know what our demands are. Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Tear down this wall. Do you recognize that wrecking ball? That makes a most distinctive sound. Tear down, tear down, tear down this wall. From your skyscrapers and try to sniff the wind, and you say
you don't know what our demands are.
But your windows don't open and your brokers are chagrined, and you say
you don't know what our demands are.
Your accountants are counting with their fingers in the air as it dawns on your shareholders that you were unaware that there's this whole other meaning of the English word share. And you say you don't know what our demands are. Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Tear down this wall. City Bank to City Hall. The implications are profound. Tear down, tear down, tear down this wall. This is a worldwide wake-up call. We stuck a post-it to your crown. Tear down, tear down.
Was called Our Demands, again from Life and Love, Tears and Laughter, Charlie King. The story that I read to you about the medical marijuana bill that could backfire was from the March 27th Chronicle, and it's by Jackie Bryant, whoever that person may be. Ego freelance journalist, apparently. Hard for even me to follow, got to tell you. But I think it's probably worth grabbing an interview with someone local who knows something about this and see what its implications here are for Santa Cruz County. A lot of people favored the Section 64, which legalized some commercial sales of marijuana, not realizing that it would follow essentially a taxation and serious restrictions on medical cannabis, which Proposition 215 had given fairly free rein to. So it was a big boon for large commercial enterprises selling marijuana, but not necessarily for medical users, collectives, or smaller businesses. And of course, the taxing situation is still pretty seriously horrendous for smaller cannabis dealers, as I understand it, and cannabis suppliers. I'll get in touch, if I ever can, with Pat Malo, who is kind of, I don't know if I'd call him the resident expert, but he seems to know a lot more about it and follow more closely the Board of Supervisors' ins and outs and twists and turns than I do. And before we check out the subsequent conversation with Keith McHenry, after the hearing had come and done its thing, here's a couple of speakers at the town clock in the midst of a Food Not Bombs meal, giving you some thoughts on a variety of issues.
We're talking with
Sean.
And Sean, you're saying that, you know, I interrupted your conversation by saying, are you outside? And you said, yeah, but you prefer to be indoors if the truth were known.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dignity, yeah. You know, I mean, I think it's every, you know, food, clothing, and shelter, it's everyone's right. And, I mean, you know, great nations are judged by the way they treat their people and their animals, for that matter. But, you know, some of them are getting treated more like animals lately.
How do you rate Santa Cruz?
I think actually, well, I'd have to give it kind of like maybe like a C- to almost a D+ on the homeless issue, because I just don't feel like there's any real solutions, though they've made progress on certain things, the homeless shelter here, and certain things they've made some progress on, but as far as people are actually getting housed, I don't see any progress.
Have you used the shelter here much?
Yes. Yeah, and I think, you know, it's gotten a little better with the way that the showers are run there and stuff like that.
Mobile showers still at 115 Coral?
Yeah, they have the mobile showers, which has been a little bit of an uptick compared to, and of course, shower the people. Thank God for them. But, you know, it's been, the most part, you know, permanent housing is the idea here, and I just think that there's been, you know, they're not really doing what they need to be doing with the funding. You know, this you know, $1 billion from, you know, is allocated to fund homelessness, and I don't really see people being housed, and I think that there needs to be, coming from people who are on the street, and then there's other things to being housed too, like giving up certain rights and privacies and certain things like that, so that, and conditions, you know, it's housed on a condition. And
has anyone promised you in the course of your travels in Santa Cruz and visits to shelters, conversations with service providers, actual housing within a certain period of time? Has that ever been made? Has anybody ever suggested that was a likelihood for you with all the money that's being spent?
Yeah, I mean, there was this Operation Lockheed that was supposed to happen for the Monterey County region. But, you know, we're talking about Santa Cruz and both Monterey counties, which I think have done a very poor job, very poor, considering the amount of resources they have in the city of Monterey. And, well, if you're a woman, you're a lot more likely to get housed. If you're an older adult male, I'd say it's looking pretty slim for any kind of housing in Monterey County. And you know, it's pretty bad here in Santa Cruz. This is, I mean, it's just, I mean, that tent city over there in the park, I mean, that just can't be a permanent thing. I mean, they really need to find housing and get people out of the San Lorenzo Park there on the San Lorenzo River.
Have you spent much time in the benchlands?
Excuse me?
Have you spent much time in the San Lorenzo Park benchlands?
No, I've been through there, and I just, it's I don't feel safe there. And that's another thing. It's just not a safe, conductive, healthy environment. You know, I know they sort of regulate themselves in there, but it's just, as far as like moving to more of a constructive, eco-village, sustainable lifestyle, which really, under this Green New Deal, under the United Nations, Agenda 21, they're pushing us into this, you know, new Green Deal. They need to be offering more green solutions. And so, you know, land, federal land grant, federal land opening up for homeless, even state land that could be opened up for homeless would be a big step in the right direction of creating an eco-sustainable kind of, where people can feel more like they're being a part of something, and you know, getting back into society means feeling like you're a whole person on the inside, spiritually connected, and spiritually connected with the planet. I don't think if people are given the dignity, it's more than just a free meal. This is about getting people to be able to feel like they have a purpose in life, and that's you know, it's hard when you're on the streets to feel like you have a purpose for anything when you're looked down upon all the time. It's I see a lot of that. And
more in Santa Cruz or more in Monterey?
I see it in both places, actually. Yeah, Santa Cruz really rough here, and you know, I believe it's got the highest rate of actually homeless children in the state of California, which is also a shocker.
Has it changed much in your tenancy here? How long have you been here?
I've been here since 1980.
So you've got quite a swath of time to look over.
Oh yeah, I've seen big changes, like housing go through the roof. You know, housing being bought up by Silicon Valley here in Santa Cruz, specifically after 89, after the earthquake. And, you know, prices skyrocketed. A lot of local people couldn't afford to live here anymore. A lot of people had to leave Santa Cruz that were born and raised around here. Monterey is just as bad. You can't find anything anymore. I mean, there used to be granny units. There used to be small little places you could rent that were sustainable, that were low enough that you could, you know, afford it. But now it's almost impossible. And now with inflation under this great reset, it's just going to keep rising. Things are just going to get tougher unless we can really find some real true leadership, which I think most of the leadership when it comes to the homeless issue has failed us. And most of the leaders around the homeless issue within Santa Cruz, here, the Bay Area, and you could probably many other places in California have failed us. With a lot of it with you know, like in Los Angeles with the Supreme Court decision to allow people to sleep in their vehicle, but city ordinances, like the city of Monterey, still going after people, law-abiding people that work, live in their cars, some are homeless, some work. You know, housing is a right, and you can't go after people in vehicles if the Supreme Court stated in the state of California you have the right to be in your vehicle. But city ordinances say no. So this is a big contradiction to, like, the way people are treated homeless. And I often feel like the homeless are targeted. They're targeted in many, many different ways. Targeted by, it could be anything from parking meters to don't like the way you look to you can't be here anymore. A lot of violations of people's, you know, civil liberties.
Any encounters with police
and
less?
Civil liberties and American sovereignty, yeah.
Any encounters with local police that you want to comment on?
You know, not too much. Because I think many people who are actually homeless are actually law-abiding citizens and are actually not out doing crimes. But, you know, not addicts either. So there's a lot of people who just happen to be in a very, very a tough situation, who are just not able to find housing or to afford housing under the current market in California.
And you're one of them, I would take it.
Oh, I've been one of them a long time, and if I could find affordable rent, I would have tried to find it a long time ago. I haven't been able to find any affordable rent. And for someone that wants to, you know, doesn't want to be with roommates and all this kind of thing, with roommates and that sort of thing, you know, you need, there's many people that like their own privacy, and put it that way. So it's difficult for everybody to be living with roommates.
And we've been talking with them.
Sure. Yes.
I'm examining some interesting jewelry. Town clock. I'm learning some of the tricks of the trade. You're not going to divulge how much energy you're going to actually finding this material.
That's true, yeah. That's the labor of love.
And these are wraps that are, what do we call these, earrings, pendants?
It's a talisman.
They look pretty reasonably priced to me. This is not any kind of fancy. For some of your work here.
Well, it costs more if you drive a Tesla.
I see. So abandon your Tesla before coming here.
No, be honest. You know, honesty is a good policy.
So there's a vending law that passed in California first reading. I don't know if you heard about that. It's throwing vendors into a limited spaces. I don't know. I don't think they can limit what you're selling this time because of the state law, but I think they're limiting the hours you can do it, the places you can do it. They may have the move-along law back. I'm not sure about that. What's your thought about that, if you want to say?
Well, you know, I do a performance whenever I'm, quote-unquote, vending. So they're going to have a hard time knowing if I'm accepting a donation for my performance. You know, I can be playing the drum for a half hour. I can sell some jewelry for a couple minutes. I can sing a song, a cappella.
Any song you'd like to sing at the moment?
I like to expose hypocrites.
Is that the name of your first song, perhaps?
No, I'm just saying that, I mean, I mean, not everyone wants to wait in line at the welfare office. So, you know, the people that are creating microeconomies and creating their own wealth, that should be promoted. I mean, a lot of people come downtown for the street vendors.
I, of course, agree with you. The question is, what kind of response can be made by the community to deal with a city council that seems to be, I don't know if they're concerned with making money or driving poor street vendors away. What's your thought about that?
I'd take it case by case. I mean, I don't see it as a city council. I see it as individuals. And we've all got a lot to learn, and nobody's perfect. But at the same time, I feel like if you're not actually holding the council in person, if you're doing it via Zoom, that doesn't feel like a council to me. Because you're too disconnected from the other council members.
And from the community.
Yeah, I mean, the community is part of that process, even if they're not part of the city council. Yeah, I guess we're going to have a hard time.
Like if you want.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be a hard time for the vendors that have, like, six tables, seven tables. They're going to probably have to downsize a little bit.
Are there vendors that actually have so many tables? Or no, you at your time, you used to have two tables.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're selling bigger stuff, so they need more space. And maybe they only come out on the weekend or whatever, but it's just a give or take. I mean, you know, we all got to share the space. Some people do get a little territorial. I can see it from both sides, you know. And I'm sure the city council people, they're going to come around. I'm sure they have good intentions.
Forgiving heart, I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're people. You know, they're probably stressed out. And
you get into politics, you become a part of a machine rather than you kind of abandon your human identity for your role as whatever it is, where it's police or on the council. And then you become really something different than you were. That's what I've found. You may have found differently.
I think a lot of them really open-minded, compassionate politicians have become disillusioned. I think they have dropped out and maybe more of the, like, financially motivated types have risen to the places of power. So what we need is the oversight, censure of people to come and say, hey, like, stay on track, you know? I agree.
And we've been talking with, if you wish to say.
My name's Jaya.
Thank you, Jaya.
You're welcome.
We're talking with
Sean.
And Sean, you're... So now we come to part two of the interview with Keith McHenry on the return trip back from San Jose to Santa Cruz, where, we get into a variety of topics, some of it springing from the court case, some of it springing from goodness knows where.
So today is, March 29th. We're returning from the hearing, which I'm not quite sure what they did other than the lengthy plea by Chris Doyen. All he said was, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, to the judge. At least he didn't say, Your Honor. I mean, that was a good thing, I thought. I give him credit for that one. Any reaction to the hearing? I don't know. There was nothing really surprising. He pled guilty to all, 3 or 4 charges, and it was postponed for sentencing until June 28th, right?
I think it's the 28th. So the, it was interesting listening to the federal prosecutor read out the, particularly the Orlando case, and to read the, and to actually state, well, both of the things that I think was most interesting was is reading the camping ban law into the record, and reading the large group feeding ordinance in Orlando into the record.
Or at least the reference to it. I don't think there was much of the substance of it mentioned.
The camping ban one, there was not much substance. There was more substance to the Orlando large group feeding, where to me, it seemed like it would be obviously damning and then embarrassing to be standing up there saying that somebody that did a nonviolent protest against that was should go to federal prison for that. I thought it was not the federal prosecutor and I actually did a nice concise job with the large group, describing the large group feeding, which was that you had to get, permit for each park. You could only do 2 times in a year in a park. And the idea that adult humans that are being paid in Buddy Dyer's case, probably a couple $100,000 a year to be a mayor, would actually think that even made any sense. Either they're just so viciously cruel, or they're just have this amazing class blindness that they can't imagine the logistics. Well, a lot of it is that they don't do anything physical in the world anyway, so they have no idea what actually doing things in the
they
world.
They being?
Like federal prosecutors or judges or, city city officials. They have no idea what feeding people is about. If you come up with an imaginary idea that your people are going to move around from each park to each park each week to find food, and you have no resources and you have to do it by walking and you have to defend all your property and you haven't, it's bad enough that you're going to only eat twice a week anyway. It's insanity, it's just like here in Santa Cruz where, that's why I wrote that essay that then became John Malcolm's article in the Sentinel, belatedly. Because the reality is there's all these logistics to just making sure people get food, and then there's the logistics of being a homeless person, right? It's like this immense trip, but they create these weird laws, like the large group feeding law and large group being 25. We were having so many more people come to eat and in Orlando, and now it's like in the photos I've most recently seen, it's like wraps around City Hall. So Yeah, it's just incredible that you could be, and I assume a federal prosecutor in San Jose gets, you know, probably $200,000 a year to do that. And they're just living in the, it's like a, such a it's embarrassing that we, you know, or those people should be embarrassed that they would even stand up there in a court before a judge and read that law, and then in conjunction with sending somebody to prison for protesting that law. I mean, that's incredible.
What I noticed was at the courtroom itself, the most natural human response, which is to laugh or become outraged, is completely suppressed by the whole structure of the court. And so it doesn't even begin to, there's no access to real human feeling. And so how can you, I mean, even, you know, the idea that somebody should be forced to flee and live in secret for, what, 11 years abroad for this kind of behavior is, you know, absurd, outrageous, say whatever you want, but it's something that if you're considering the actual human costs over the day-to-day and the kind of pain that it has produced, it's something that would provoke a real cry of rage, and it would be necessary to say, to express that in order to get a real response, if the court were doing a real response to this situation. But of course they're not. It's a sort of a zombified, automated, one size fits all, in a way self-perpetuating kind of a juggernaut.
Yeah, well, I think that's the, you know, we're going towards this dystopian corporate future where everything is sterilized, you know, like the, you know, just the building of the buildings in these cities where it's completely sterilized, everything's inhuman, and things like eating and pooping and things that people have been done since the beginning of people are just completely, you know, outlawed or stifled. But you can, you know, but any kind of technological oppression is hailed and supported, you know. And you know, and yeah, I think the court is a reflection of the soulness of the entire economic and political system, you know, that...
Kathleen, did you have any reaction that you wanted to say to the hearing?
No, thank you. It's just... I'll get too distracted from driving, but...
I got you. Yeah, I don't want you to go off the road, particularly since I'm in the back seat, you know.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, it's a... When you, yeah, so that's why I call the city council in Santa Cruz celluloid avatars, because they're essentially not real. I mean, and they don't make decisions that are about reality except for to harm people. You know, or you look at the, you know, it's just, the whole thing is completely outrageous, and you do get a sense that, you know, there's going to be two tiers of society. There's going to be those of us that stand outside all this stuff and just continue to survive on the streets and are actually relatively free. At least our minds are free. And then there's going to be everybody else that falls for the propaganda of the corporate media and the education system and the court system and all that. You know, it's just
shit.
It's
oh, shit, you guys.
No, you're doing fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah,
you're
cool.
Close to the turnoff.
I thought I missed it.
Yeah, no, it's a double turnoff. So, anyway, it is really frightening and brutal.
Let me get back to this issue that I was... You talked to me about this off mic earlier when we were kind of getting ready to go into court. There's been a lot of... there's been a lot less protest, at least locally in Santa Cruz, in the last year or two, partially, you know, COVID fear related, partially gentrification related. But one of the other considerations that you brought up is that the nature of protest has changed because the possible violent responses by authorities are so much more likely, perhaps. I'm not quite sure how you put it.
Okay, so in the original book, Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, my co-author was very, very, he really, and I agree with the spirit of this, of non-cooperation. So he would go limp and make, and I'm not going to be cooperating with being taken to jail. And so anytime he was doing a civil disobedience of some sort, which was only a couple of times around food, it was mostly anti-war, anti-nuclear.
You're talking about C.T. Butler, right?
Yeah, this would be C.T. Lawrence Butler. He, so we had a section in there on going limp and non-cooperation. And
I've never done that?
No, I've never done that. I only did civil disobedience in a traditional sense. One time at the Pentagon in like 1979, but I escaped from custody, which was a fortunate thing. And then I did two theatrical civil disobedience, where you get arrested intentionally type of thing in Tucson during the beginning of the Iraq War and Afghanistan War. Otherwise, even though I've been arrested over 120 times or maybe 150 times, something like that, they're always usually just for living, you know, like actually serving food. I don't do that thing. I was
engaged in legitimate activity, which they regard as illegitimate, and go in and try to stop you.
Correct, yeah. I figure I get arrested enough for that I didn't need to do the others. In fact, at the beginning of the Iraq War, or whatever war it was, I get... The one after 9/11, I was...
Okay, that was 2003.
Yeah, I did United Neighbors weapons inspection of Raytheon missile systems to see if they had weapons of mass destruction there, and I was arrested doing that, walking onto Raytheon property. That would be somewhat like a civil disobedience of a traditional sort. And the other one was we did a die-in in front of a congressperson's office that around that same time, but I also got arrested for just marching down the street one time on a Sunday with no traffic, and pretty brutally arrested, and then several people were injured in that march.
You had a difference of opinion with C.T. Butler. Some of it had to do with commercialization, but some of it also had to do with a difference of opinion on the proper way to advise people to resist unjust authority and protest.
No, that's not actually accurate. I mean, one, the first is accurate, the second is not. So when I went through the original book, which was written in 1992,
it was called
Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, I did not object to the sections in there on going limp and doing non-cooperation. I mean, philosophically, I was completely in support of that. And in those days, when you did that, you might get banged up, but you weren't going to be hospitalized. By the time I rewrote the book as Hungry for Peace,
which was
I don't remember where I rewrote that, but which is weird, but
more or less.
Yeah, in the. Yeah, it must have been in, I don't know when that book came out, in the 2000s sometimes. And so I was living in Taos, New Mexico, because I hired an editor that wasn't so good with grammar, actually. So I was in Taos. I was a Taos editor. So that had to be after 2003, and I think it must have been in something like...
In the course of a decade, your sense of what the most appropriate approach was has changed?
Yeah, well, the point of that book was I didn't want, the point to me is I didn't want to be, as an older seasoned activist, suggesting to younger people who would be reading my book that there was some kind of, it was safe to do what I wrote in the first book. And the reason that I say that, originally I thought I was just going to copy the first book And that was funny because I actually, the only reason I had a copy of the first book is a person who was arrested for possession of marijuana in Colorado, of all things, had to do community service, and I've lost the computer program that the original book was written on. That company no longer existed, and that program no longer existed, and I could no longer access the files. So he retyped the entire book, and then I went to think I was just going to update it, and then as I read that part, I said, no, I can't let people think that that's a safe thing to do. So that's where I got the impression, why I changed that. It wasn't a personal dispute between me and CT. Now, the dispute, reason I wrote that book, and the two reasons why I completely rewrote the book, one so much, or maybe more, but one of them is that, we had no real computer files of that book. We were just reprinting it as from film, and I was adding, like, you know, four pages at the beginning, four pages at the end. And my publisher, Chaz Buffet at C-Sharp Press, suggested that that was getting old because we kept selling out and we kept having new editions. So I decided to rewrite it. But the other thing is that I had been in a dispute with C.T. Lawrence Butler over the issue of... He approached me to try to become my manager and use his and my fame, so to speak, to make money off of the fact that we both were co-founders of Food Not Bombs. And I felt that was in no way in the spirit of Food Not Bombs, and particularly found that it would be crushing to the thousands of young people that were doing Food Not Bombs if something like that were to occur. And that would have been before, that must have been in like about 2010 or something like that, that conflict happened. And he was pressuring me to basically parlay our fame into that. And I didn't want to do it. Let me get the...
You've written, I don't want to get too much into you, Keith, although that almost always happens. And when we spoke, I guess it was yesterday or the day before, I think, maybe it was yesterday, I was looking for updates, and you frequently have a lot of, you're doing a lot of stuff to keep the Food Not Bombs meal going and maintaining connection with Food Not Bombs organizations elsewhere, and also keeping an eye on what's going on with anti-homeless laws in Santa Cruz, as well as getting reports from homeless people about, and renters who are displaced, about what's going on there. So I have to ask you, even though I asked you recently, anything new?
Well, I mean, I think the last time I spoke to you was I'd just gone through San Lorenzo Park again, and no one there had heard any updates on being evicted from the park, and that's still seemed to be the case the day after that I went down there to see if any news. People are complaining that many more people, so when I was hanging out there the other day, people were mentioning that a lot more people seem to be showing up. I was overwhelmed with tent requests, which I'm sure will happen again today. So I ran out of my first load of tents almost immediately when I arrived at the meal, so I had to go back and get another load of tents. And what I do is I buy every tent under like $40 at Big Five, negotiate with them, I think I bought 24 tents last time. I still might have 8 left out of that, so that's like that's insane.
How often do you give a tent to someone who asks, and how often do you decline to do it for different reasons?
I will hassle there's one or two people that are repeat requesters, and I deny them every second or third time because I know they're just basically, I don't totally begrudge them selling the tents to buy whatever it is they need, but I don't want them to
make a business
of it. Yeah, make it a huge business out of it, you know.
And we'll hear more about the woes and wherefores of being one of the few suppliers of homeless survival gear in Santa Cruz, free survival gear, after this music.
Grandpa Babe died while he was shaving. Took him 3 days before they found him out. In the cabin where he lived up on Mill Creek, where the flies swarmed around his mouth. The day he died was 20 years since the fire that took Mildred, Vicey, little James, and Brenda and Franklin there beside them. They say since then he weren't the same. And it's hot, yes it's hot, up on Middle Creek, where peace comes slow to the wicked. And it's cool, yes it's cool, under the cedar trees, where the branches brush the grave of Grandpa Babe. To make his moonshine, Mildred kept the garden out back of the house. He sold timber off the land and did some trading. He and Mildred held the place somehow. The old regulars, they spoke of retribution at the little church to which he never came. And they prayed, yes, they prayed for his salvation, that he'd burn his still house down and praise Jesus' name. And it's hot, yes, it's hot, up on Middle Creek, where peace comes slow to the wicked. It's cool, yes, it's cool under the cedar trees, where the branches brush the grave of Grandpa Babe. Some folks called him good for nothing. Some say he was just broke. But on that last day, with his hand on the razor, I wonder, did he smell smoke? I wonder, did he call to heaven? Did Mildred hear her name? And when his heart seized up on him, did he see Mildred and the children in Jesus' name through the flames? And it's hot, yes, it's hot up on Mill Creek, where peace comes slow to the wicked. And it's cool, yes, it's cool under the cedar tree, where the branches brush the grave of Grandpa Babe.
And that was called Middle Creek. In case I didn't mention it, I thought I did, but in case I didn't, the previous number by Charlie King was Our Demands. Back to Keith McHenry.
But, you know, I've been around. I know you know, if somebody's asking for... Now, the other thing that I'm getting a fair bit more stories of about these tents is that people will report that they left to go do something, came back, and somebody had moved into their tent. And I know a couple of the people that do that, I know, and I can completely imagine... So one of the people that I know has occupied at least two different people's tents over the that I've observed when they were, yeah, he was climbing into people's tents and living in them at Lot 27. And he's completely filthy and intense. He's a really nice person, but you know, he's incredibly messy. He often has food all over him, and he lays on the ground basically all the time and stuff like that. So I can totally imagine if you came back to your tent and found him in your tent, you would abandon that tent to him. So that's not unusual. But there's other cases where whole, you know, like a couple will move into somebody's tent when, and they just won't leave, and you gotta get into a huge altercation. So I hear that story once in a while as well. So
a lot of people, even a week ago, Monday, when I was trekking down the Hell's Trail and talking to a few people, they were being bulldozed out in another, you know, one of the series of sequential bulldozings that have happened in the last 6 months, whether at Highway 1 and Highway 9 or earlier in the Pogonip or after that along the initial Hell's Trail bulldozing, then the Camp Paradise bulldozing, then the Hell's Trail bulldozing, then the levee removal of tents. It seems that a lot of people are losing their property, or maybe they're taking it with them, and they're being told that, of course, this is the interesting story that probably doesn't sit too well with conservative folks in Santa Cruz, that the new sanctioned campground is the Benchlands. And therefore, because there's a sanctioned campground, the Community Services and Standards Act, which I probably am reversing the order, I think it's the Community Standards and Services Act, it's a new camping ban, can go into effect because there is a supposedly space for 150 people, and storage as well, because they can always store their stuff in their tents, see, in the San Lorenzo Park benchlands. But I guess I'm wondering... is there a lot of people are maybe it looks like are losing their tents? Are they coming to you for them? And certainly it's going to be more than 24, right?
Yeah, well, there is. So, like a person wanted to know if my tent was better than a homeless person's healthcare project tent. So we all buy our tent. They buy their, in the past, they've been buying their tents at Big Five. And I buy them at Big Five, and I try to get there. I always go on a Sunday morning and then negotiate and see. They have these yellow tags, which are for sale tags, and then they are kind enough to go through the yellow tags to see which tents have gone down in price that week, and then I buy all the tents if they're, like I say, under $40, so I know this. The county does that. I did. Buy one time a bunch of them on online, but they were even worse than the cheap tents at Big Five, so I stopped that.
So HBHB is actually giving out tents too, and so is the county.
Well, I think when the county gives out tents, it's HBHB. And there was this clandestine county tent distribution that Matthew was doing, but he's retired again. He used to be one of the main people at Homeless Persons Healthcare Project. But, I did talk, so in this weird, you know, here we are, the amazingly wealthy area of the world. And Crystal, who's in the, you know, in the union, she is partially taking care of a senior and getting to bathe at their house and stuff like that. She's one of two in-house support people, but... for this person, and but she's hoping to get a, and this is sad that you get to reduce to this, but she's hoping to get into 1220 River Street to the Boneyard campground, but she hasn't yet. I mean, that's sad, man, that's happening. And then again, so I haven't been over there to see what's going on there and you know, all that. But then, you know, that's the you know, people are, like, scrambling for these, like, really inhumane locations. And because they're better than the other inhumane locations. And then the... And it is tragic that the Benchlands is being considered by allowing people to live there through our lawsuit, which they would never have been there if it wasn't for the union and Food Not Bombs and people suing federal court.
And the community coming out to stop the evictions at the upper Benchlands.
Yeah, that was a really...
Upper Duck Pond.
Yeah, that was a really important action. That gave us time to file the lawsuit, and it gave us time to have the case not be moot before it got heard, before Van Cluen. So that was super important. And the...
There was always a lot of concern that and the injunction was vacated and removed at the end of June of last year, that when that was going to happen, or soon thereafter, or certainly before the winter and the floods, they would be moving people out of the Benchlands. And the union began to meet, the Santa Cruz Homeless Union began to meet weekly to talk about strategies and try to involve itself with other organizations, Democratic Socialists, Love Boat, so forth. A Huff, even, to devise a strategy that would discourage the depopulation of the Benchlands, which actually apparently worked in a way. But on the other hand, there is still a depopulation supposedly slated for this summer. That's according to Matt Huffaker, the city manager, and his go-to guy, Larry Imwalda, or if that's his name. What kind of strategies, and I know the union hasn't been meeting recently for all kinds of reasons, but as sort of an onlooker who's had some experience with this stuff, although admittedly not a Benchlands resident, you would have, what kind of considerations would you be thinking about to deal with this upcoming crisis?
Well, I mean, it is very difficult. We still have all the Santa Cruz neighbors documents that we were going to use. I still have a pile of those and stuff. I don't know. We might want to reactivate whatever that was. I know one thing did come out of that, which was...
Explain more clearly what you mean.
So we were trying to go around the neighborhood and where people were staying, or in other neighborhoods where a potential camp could be put, and build solidarity amongst the unhoused, I mean, the housed people, to not, you know, organize to get rid of people, and a little bit of that did happen on the west side that seemed, but I don't know what kind of impact that had, but it does seem like the sympathy, because of the extreme poverty and people being on the edge, I get a sense. So our problem is that there's a silent majority that's completely disorganized, whereas the people that are vocally against homeless people are connected, are organized, and know each other. But really, a vast majority of the people in the town seem to show some sympathy, and that's reflected in their coming by and bringing things to Food Not Bombs, and it's reflected in their coming to the Benchlands with supplies, and a lot of it is, like, you know, churches and stuff that are, small congregations that are just do it out of the goodness of their heart, things like that. So I think there is a lot of sympathy now for people living outside. And I think partially that is because the people living outside aren't so visible in a way, because they all are on the Benchlands mostly. You know, they're always frequently kicked out of doorways. Although the doorways are, I just saw the doorways having a bunch of people again in downtown the last couple of days. And there's actually new people that I haven't seen before that may have been unhoused in other communities and showed up. It's hard to really say. They could have been just housed recently and recently unhoused, although I didn't you know, often I can tell that because they, you know, look stunned and have still have good clothes on. Yeah, I don't know. We have to come up with some kind of thing. I don't know what to... And then reading that ordinance, it just seems completely...
The CSSO ordinance?
Yeah, that seems completely...
That's the new camping ban. You can find it, by the way, anybody listening who wants to go research it, just go to the city's website or look up Santa Cruz Municipal Code. Make sure you put Santa Cruz, California Municipal Code. And then you'll find... 6.36 is most of that ordinance. And then, of course, the OVO ordinance is for those folks who are in vehicles. In any vehicles, even. It's not just apparently oversized. Well, actually, that's a good question. I think there may be a tightening generally of vehicles. I mean, I think the actual, for example... Shrinking the parking spaces is one of the strategies that was used along Westcliff to eliminate people who had so-called oversized vehicles, but also just RVs that weren't terribly large, but that wouldn't fit into a small, compact car parking space.
It's that thing. You can tell that the people that wrote that, both of those ordinances, have absolutely no clue as to what people are going through. I mean, the most tragic thing is the amount of people that come to me that lose their vehicles and the frustration of being ticketed. That's one thing I've got to remember to do. In fact, today I've got to pay the Funa Bombs van parking tickets now because they're ticketing us as much as they can at the town clock.
That's new?
That's new, yeah. And then the other thing is that they're also coming in with a bunch of cops and giving everybody that's smoking tickets and stuff like that to try to torment people into not coming there, which is completely insane. And I think you pointed out at one point that the town clock became a park as a way of closing it and so on. And one of the things that they could do is, like, anybody with a dog off the leash there can be ticketed if you have a, you know, there's all kinds of park laws that they can just
can also use the stay away order approach. Since it's within the park's jurisdiction, they can start issuing stay away orders without going through a court, just on the basis of getting one infraction citation, not even a citation that has been taken to court where you've been convicted, not even a citation that has been taken to court by the city attorney, just issued by a police officer. And they can ban you from there for, I think it's either a day or a week. And if you had another incident in another park anywhere, it can be up to a month. And then after that, it's 6 months. And then it's a year and a half. And if you happen to be near a school, all those are tripled.
Yeah, that's an insanity. It's interesting that they've never actually banned Portuguese Tony from the park, even though they do ticket him almost every day, and occasionally he gets. In fact, he was surprised to find us there when we first moved to the town, back to town clock, because he'd been in jail for building a fire in the town clock, he's been pretty funny to deal with. The cops often do come there and ticket him, but he hasn't gotten a stay away order for that. But whereas Fox is not allowed to be, he got a stay away order from Pacific Avenue for smoking cigarettes on Pacific Avenue, and so then
convicted in court, or just a stay away order that was given ex cathedra by a police officer.
He came to me the other day, saying he just had been in court over that stay away order because the district attorney was trying to get this stay away order to also be at the town clock, and he argued that the that's where he's eating and he's where he's participating in the anti-war protest with Funa Bombs, And the judge said, oh, we're not giving you a stay-away order from the town clock.
A risky First Amendment-wise.
Yeah, yeah. So that, he was very proud to say he invoked food on bombs and
protests. It's interesting
protests.
He gets it on the avenue, and he got it, apparently, I don't know, it sounds like he may have gotten it without even going to court on Pacific Avenue, on the sort of declaration that the Parks and Rec has decided this is their jurisdiction. I mean, they used to be walking up and down with police officers on Pacific Avenue as, you know, part of their Andy Mills-oriented six Parks and Rec Rangers joined the police department in their beat. And that may have been taken back a couple of years ago, but, in fact, the original ordinance that allows these stay-away ordinances to go into effect on the simply assertion of it's a Parks and Rec person, or I think a police officer on Parks and Rec territory. I could be in error on some of that, I'm not sure. But it was extremely, extremely powerful, and also the power of the code section in the municipal code gives the city manager the power to extend, just by assertion, Parks and Rec jurisdiction beyond parks to all kinds of other places. And in fact, all kinds of other places, such as Pacific Avenue, are already mentioned in the jurisdiction of the Parks Authority in the same section that covers the stay-away ordinances.
Yeah, well, here's another one that just came about, which I think will come into effect in May, maybe in late April, is the... I don't know if they had the second reading. Maybe they had the second reading. I don't know where they're at. But that, I got the impression from reading some article that all these restrictions on Pacific Avenue have come back. That you have to pay $35. You have to go pay for a permit for $35. I think it's for the year, which...
Vending?
And then you now have to set up in a little... some kind of designated places, which I would assume will be where the little brass knobs are, and mainly the main point of it was to ban vending and having tables and stuff down by the boardwalk and the wharf and all that, and on West Cliff, but it also includes all this restrictions on Pacific Avenue, and I figure that I guess the city attorney somehow figured out how they could comply with whatever that last state court ruling was. That
state law.
Yeah, so that everybody was, it's just been really nice atmosphere on Pacific Avenue. And I'm sure most businesses actually appreciate the, all the energy that's brought to Pacific Avenue, because it brings people to Pacific Avenue. But there does seem to be some on there that don't want anything unusual to occur and are stuck up and control freaks and all that. But anyway, so that's back again, and it'll be interesting to see how they enforce that. And
they're enforcing it under the display device ordinance rather than a vending ordinance, by claiming that any display device, i.e. a table, a blanket, anything capable of holding tangible things, was the strange wording that they used, very expansive wording that allowed the city to declare that not just a person giving away their stuff or a person engaging in political speech had to move, for example, every hour. They could be severely restricted to be within these tabling areas. They couldn't be on the ground.
Right here, yeah.
Robert, excuse me, when I get up to...
And that was a kind of rough cut of, I think, an interesting conversation that Keith and I had en route to and from the Christopher Doyen Commander X hearing, which really wasn't... there wasn't much happening there except a lengthy recitation of the rights that... Chris had to give up in order to surrender himself and his right to appeal and his right to appeal the appeal, and it just went on and on. Depressing. But that's the court system that we face. One bright note, I actually had a brief interview which got eaten up by the or maybe it never happened. I thought it was happening. But I interviewed a guy who was doing some petitioning, a black guy, in front of Trader Joe's, as say, on and the parking lot side of Trader Joe's in downtown Santa Cruz, which usually, for the last 3 or 4 years, has been verboten to be there to do any petitioning. And that actually was the situation with even the ACLU people who were, the American Civil Liberties Union people who were doing some petitioning were told to leave or get ticketed. I think they actually got a ticket. And then they, I think the city ended up dismissing it, but the ACLU defended or actually decided not to ticket there in the future, or not to petition there in the future for fear of tickets. And this one guy said he held off the police. He said, look, the Pruneyard decision, which is a court decision, which says you can set up a table even if the management of the shopping center or the business in which you're in front of which you're ticket you're actually doing your work doesn't want you there, you can still be there because it's a public area. But not in Santa Cruz and not at Trader Joe's. And worst of all, or certainly in addition to that, the local ACLU has not fought it in any meaningful way. So who knows? Maybe I'll be setting up a table there at some point. I've kind of wanted to go back there and just do it. And it's a possibility. In any case, this is, let's hear a final number from Charlie King. And I'll say goodnight. Get back to me if you have any reports that you think might be profitably included. As you can see, bookings are pretty sparse in these netcasts. And it's beginning to look like we may reduce it to one a week or one every 2 weeks or one every 2 months. I don't know. Simply because a combination of low energy, who knows, maybe it's health, maybe it's the age of your host here. But get in touch if you've been hassled, see stuff you think is important, feel you you got information you want to put out that isn't being put out by the regular media. Get in touch, 423-4833, in area code 831. Thanks for listening.
Just one more night on the road, but a night with a curious twist. For you seemed to light up the room when you swept in and blew me a kiss. A flourish that opened our hearts and caught us both quite unaware. With a smile on your beautiful face and a toss of your beautiful hair, I remember the care that we took to savor one step at a time. The visits that ended too soon, a smile on your beautiful face and a toss of your beautiful hair. smile cannot light every room. There were times when we barely held on to hope just beginning to bloom. Still you rose out of trouble and loss with grace, loving kindness and care, and a smile on your beautiful face with a toss of your beautiful hair. What a wonderful journey it's been, all the stories and songs that we share. What a wonderful home we have made, what comfort so common and rare. And even when we are apart, I still see you standing there with a smile on your beautiful face and a toss of your beautiful hair. And even though we are apart, I still see you waiting there with a smile on your beautiful face and a toss of your beautiful hair.
Was Song for Karen from Life and Love, Tears and Laughter, Charlie King, 2017.